Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Good afternoon and welcome to Africa Link on this Thursday, December the 1st. I'm Eunice Njiro in Bonn, Germany.
And I'm Oli Tangen Jr. with what's trending on social media and on our Facebook page, DW Africa.
Coming up in today's program, it's World AIDS Day, and we head to South Africa where there is a trial of a new HIV vaccine.
We know that we won't get complete control or even eradication of the HIV epidemic unless we have a vaccine that can protect people and make sure they don't become infected.
Gambians cast their ballots, and we get to hear from our correspondent on the ground.
I talked to the chairman of the Independent Electoral Commission. He told me that he was satisfied, and the only bad side was long queues and long waiting times because of the huge turnout.
And we are going to be staying in Gambia for social media today, where voting is taking place under a complete internet blackout.
But first, we find out what's been happening around the world.
I'm Mark Caldwell with the DW News. Gambians have been casting their ballots in a presidential election that poses the strongest challenge yet to the country's leader, Yahya Jammeh, who came to power in a coup 22 years ago. An internet blackout was in force in the tiny West African nation as voters headed to polling booths. Marta Colomer from Amnesty International told DW she found this blanket of silence over the country worrying.
We are really concerned about this silence because there is no way of checking what is happening in the country and if human rights violations are taking place.
Jammeh faces a previously unknown businessman, Adama Barrow, who was chosen as a flag bearer by a group of political parties who have joined forces for the first time. The head of the UN Human Rights Commission, Yasmin Sucha, has said that ethnic cleansing was taking place in South Sudan, where the stage was set for a repeat of the Rwandan genocide. The UN official was speaking at the end of a visit to South Sudan. The allegations have been denied by the country's president, Salva Kiir. This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. Today, December the 1st, is World AIDS Day, when people have the opportunity to unite worldwide in the fight against HIV. One campaigner in New York was the model Naomi Campbell.
I stand in solidarity with the millions of young women and adolescent girls growing up in the world that puts them at risk of HIV or dying from AIDS. I'm talking about the triple threat young women face, not knowing her HIV status, not accessing life-saving treatment, and not being empowered to protect herself from HIV.
The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, has warned that new HIV infections among adolescents could rise by 60% if progress on reaching vulnerable populations did not improve. South Africa has just launched a major new trial in the search for an HIV vaccine. The price of oil swept to a six-week high today after OPEC agreed to rein in crude output to clear a glut. Yesterday, the oil cartel agreed to its first output cut since 2008, finally taking action after global oil prices had fallen by more than a half over the last 2 years. A court in Nigeria has refused to grant bail to a Biafran activist, Nnamdi Kanu, who faces charges of treason, operating a pirate radio station, and belonging to an unlawful organisation. Kanu leads the campaign by the Igbo people for a separate Biafra state and has been in custody since October 2015. As well as refusing bail, the judge ordered that Kanu's case should be heard within the next 2 months. For more news and information, please visit our website, dw.com. I'm Mark Caldwell.
You're listening to Africa Link. On World AIDS Day today, we head to South Africa, where a large-scale trial of a new HIV vaccine has been launched with the hope of bringing an end to the pandemic. The study called HVTN-702 has enrolled 5,400 sexually active women and men aged between 18 and 35 in 15 identified sites across the country. Tuzo Kumalo from Johannesburg brings us more.
South Africans from all walks of life gathered in different parts of the country on Thursday to commemorate the World AIDS Day. In his address to the nation, Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa called on all South Africans to stand firm against HIV and AIDS.
We want to reduce the infections that are running at 266,000 a year. We want to reduce the deaths that are running at well over 130,000. Yes, we shall end this pandemic come 2030.
This year's commemorations were accompanied by good news following the launch of a new HIV vaccine trial. For a country with over 6 million people living with HIV, the trials could have not come at a better time. The study has been developed from a 2009 trial in Thailand that had an HIV infection prevention of over 30%. Professor Linda Gale-Becker is co-chair for the study, which is known as HVTN-702. She says the ultimate goal is to stop HIV infection.
We know that we won't get complete control or even eradication of the HIV epidemic unless we have a vaccine that can protect people and make sure they don't become infected. And we're very optimistic that this time around we're going to be able to push that vaccine efficacy up to a range where regulators will be very interested to license. And if we can license a vaccine, we really do begin to see a game changer in the HIV epidemic.
But Anton Fauci, director at the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, says although the trials are a milestone in the search for an HIV vaccine, it is too early to start celebrating.
It will take at least a couple of years to determine if that vaccine works. If it does, then hopefully we'll be closer to where we need to be.
Meanwhile, South Africans have rallied behind the World Health Organization's call for free distribution of HIV self-test kits. The global health body, WHO, has urged nations, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, to promote the use of self-testing kits as an additional arsenal in the fight against HIV and AIDS.
Tuzo Kumalo reporting. Gambians are casting their ballots this Thursday in a presidential election widely expected to keep the country's ruler of more than two decades in power. All internet and telephone access in the small West African nation was shut down hours ahead of the election. This comes at a time when President Yahya Jammeh's 22-year rule is seriously being challenged for the first time. Our very own Adrian Krish is in Gambia, and I spoke to him and wanted to find out how the voting process was going on.
Well, I was at a polling station in the capital, Banjul, this morning, where also President Yahya Jammeh went to vote there. And it was a huge turnout of voters there, actually. I talked to the chairman of the Independent Electoral Commission before the president arrived, and he told me that he was satisfied, and the only bad side was long queues and long waiting times because of the huge turnout. But he actually considered it as a good sign, because last time there was already a turnout of more than 80%. Now the chairman even expects more people to vote, because he said there's no voter apathy this time due to a big opposition alliance, and everybody will be involved in the voting process.
There have been reports that there's disruption of phone and internet services, which were cut hours ahead of the polls. What can you tell us about this?
Well, exactly. The internet is completely banned here at this point of time. It's not possible to access it through your smartphones. It is also not possible using the Wi-Fi in hotels. We have to do this call actually using a satellite phone, because also international calls are not possible to do anymore. So, yes, it is restricted. There was no official statement by the government about it. Off the record, one government representative just told me it's for security reasons.
So as we're speaking, you still don't have any access to internet. Do you know when we'll have connection again?
Well, from the Ministry of Information, it was said that it's tomorrow. Other sources actually expect it to be on Saturday. Definitely, it will be a major factor to see how the election results will be taken. And I believe this is the main fear of the government, actually, that riots could break out, civil unrest could break out. And if that happens, of course, they will try to keep on blocking the internet.
There are still some political prisoners in Gambia. So what does this say about the credibility of this election?
I talked to the major opposition candidate, Adama Barrow. He actually told me that he's sure that he will win, and once he is in power, of course, the political prisoners will be freed. But if that will happen is a big question. Generally, we have to say that the situation seemed to be a little bit better here when it comes to freedom of speech. But the big question is, will it stay like this? Will the glimmer of freedom remain? And some Gambians I talked to are not that optimistic. They said it's always like that. Also during the last elections, before the election time, there's like 2 weeks of democracy in the country and then it's gone.
I was speaking to DW's Adrian Krish in the capital, Banjul.
As we heard from Adrian, Gambia is now under a complete internet blackout since yesterday. And Akamai, a company that tracks internet usage, published a graph on Twitter that shows literally like someone turned off the switch on internet coming in and out of the country. And this is leading many people to question the motives behind the blackout. And Ricardo Gonzalez said, without internet or access to international calls, can this be a sign of free and fair elections? While others are just offering support for the people of Gambia, Faya Faye wrote, thoughts and prayers to every Gambian voting today.
But even without the blackout, the news is that polling is taking place.
Absolutely. Jeffrey Smith, who is on the ground there in Gambia, posted a photo of a long line of people waiting patiently to vote. And he wrote that Gambia standing tall today despite threats, arrests, an internet and phone blackout, electricity cuts and borders closed. Hashtag Gambia decides.
And Gambians are voting in a unique way indeed, are they?
That's right. Gambians a bit different than other countries. They use marbles and actually place them into green, silver and purple ballot drums, depending on who they are backing. This is a story that we will be covering as the days move on and as the results start coming in.
Thank you very much, Ole. We need friends. That's how one can summarize Russian President Vladimir Putin's State of the Nation address. Putin stressed his efforts to forge a partnership with US President-elect Donald Trump. But he also mentioned his plans for Crimea, which Russia controversially annexed from Ukraine in 2014. Leah Albrecht brings us more.
Standing in front of federal lawmakers, Russian senators and a handful of Orthodox priests inside Moscow's parliament, the Duma, President Putin was surprisingly self-reflective. He spoke of the economic challenges Russia continues to face. Russia's economy was dealt a blow after Western countries imposed economic sanctions for the annexation of Crimea and Russia's role in fueling the conflict in eastern Ukraine. For Putin, however, the problem lies with Russia.
The main reasons for the economic slowdown lie in our internal problems. It's first of all a lack of investment in resources, modern technology, professions, competitiveness, and the defects of the business climate.
Seemingly in a positive mood, Putin went on to address foreign policy. He called on progress in Russia's partnerships with China, India, and Japan, and the new Trump administration in the US.
Contrary to certain foreign colleagues who consider Russia an adversary, we do not look for and never have looked for enemies. We need friends.
US, EU and the NATO military alliance have been wary of Russia's actions not only in the neighboring Ukraine, but also in Syria. Russia's military intervention in September 2015 greatly turned the tide in favor of President Bashar al-Assad. Putin largely ignored these concerns, but rather depicted his willingness to work with the US, especially in the fight against terrorism. But one remark will have caught the attention of his critics. Putin vowed to go ahead with the construction of a road and rail bridge to the Crimean Peninsula.
Leah Albrecht with that report.
And as we heard earlier in the show, today is indeed World AIDS Day, and people around the globe are speaking out in support of people living with AIDS and HIV. Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, said that he is turning all apples red at their Apple stores for World AIDS Day and marking 10 years of progress towards an AIDS-free generation. Yoko Ono said that if you had never been tested, please do it today and know your status. And Elton John wrote that today is World AIDS Day. Together, we have the power to end AIDS. Our world needs love and compassion more than ever. Get tested.
You're listening to Africa Link, coming to you from our studios in Bonn. Still to come here on Africa Link.
Africa! Hefte! Africa! Hefte! Africa! Hefte!
We meet an African football club in Germany called Africa FC. But first, let's turn to Cameroon. Calm is gradually returning to the University of Buea, southwest of the country, after students deserted the university campus due to violent clashes with the police. Security forces violently cracked down on the students protesting poor study conditions and what they called extortion of funds by their administration. Families are still in search of some of their children, whom they say were either arrested or have gone into hiding. DW's Moki Kinzeka travelled to Buea and sent us this report.
This ambulance rushes an unconscious young man to the regional hospital in Buea, southwestern Cameroon. The young man's identity is not yet known, but Tengu Julius, a primary school teacher, says they met the injured young man wailing around the nearby Mount Cameroon. He had button wounds all over his body.
He has wounds all over his body and was very, very weak when we met him in the bush.
Tengu Julius told me that he suspects the injured man could be one of the students from the University of Buea. Some of them have been missing since Monday's strike action that turned violent when the military invaded the university campus, beating and arresting students indiscriminately. Mrs. Ruth Abonge has just left the police office at Moliko, a neighborhood in Buea. She says she went to report that she has not heard from or seen her siblings, who are students at Buea, since the protest started.
I hear that some students were locked up, whether be it in prison cells, be it in concentration camps, police people beating on them, invading their houses, breaking their doors. We even hear cases of rape, and it is everywhere.
The university, which has around 20,000 students, was completely vacated after some of the students went on strike. They were protesting that financial grants of about $100 per registered student given by President Paul Biya had been stolen by the school's administration. They also complained that those who did not pay the same amount as the grant in registration fees were being asked to pay fines of up to $20. The university administrators fled the campus during the riot and only returned to discover that the campus is still empty. Paul Kwam Wokam, the highest government official in Buea, is calling on the students to go back to their lecture rooms while the government investigates their grievances.
Some parents even come and take back their children home. If there is no school, it is their responsibility. Government cannot put a gendarme behind each and every parent. But there is a general security that is the responsibility of the state. The state is there. Intelligence services are there. Active services are there.
Most of the students, like Nga Emanuela, are refusing to go to lecture halls until they find out what happened to their peers.
It's unthinkable that students who were peacefully marching to decry the situation in which they found themselves were brutally handled, treated like prisoners, tortured. It is really unthinkable. In a country of law, I think the military people or the officers who perpetrated all this should be brought to book.
The students' protest in Buea comes just days after lawyers and teachers in the English-speaking regions refused to call off an indefinite strike action, saying the English language was being eroded by French in the country that has French and English as official languages.
Moki Kinzeka reporting.
And Eunice, we will have reactions from social media on the situation in Cameroon later on in the show.
Uzon.
There are 25,000 football clubs across Germany, with almost 7 million members who are all organized into regional leagues. In the western German city of Cologne, there's now a new team that's mixing up the competition, Africa FC. Their players come from all over the African continent, for example, Uganda, Angola or Gabon. And they also have three Europeans among them. Malte Rover Kalman went to one of their games to take a closer look.
It's around noon on a chilly Sunday on a football pitch in Cologne. The Africa FC boys are warming up in their black jerseys that have a small map of the African continent printed on them. They're focusing on the game that lies ahead.
I'm motivated, of course, but there's also some tension before every game. It's always been like that for me, and because I'm so involved with this team, it's even more intense.
That's Cedric Mferi, the team's captain. He's 26, born and raised in Cologne, but he's half Gabonese. He's the one who founded the club. He worked through all the red tape, drummed up all the players, and got together enough money. The club's his first child, he tells his friends. It's Africa FC's first season, and because they're a new team, they have to start in Cologne's lowest league, the Kreisliga, even though many of the guys have played in higher, more competitive divisions. They want to be promoted as soon as they can, so winning today is important.
Africa FC! Africa FC! Africa FC!
As the game kicks off, Cedric's dad, Jacob, is watching from the sideline. He's actually one of the reasons Cedric founded the club. Jacob came to Cologne from Gabon in 1982 as a student, like many other Africans back then. It was a hard time for him, he says, because he missed home, and not exactly every German welcomed foreigners with open arms. But Jacob became friends with other guys from Africa, and guess what? They founded their own football club.
First and foremost, the Africans were my family back then. I've never only seen it as a football club. Someone would always listen to your problems and have some advice. I must say, without the club, I might not have stayed here.
Like Jacob supports his son from the sideline now, Cedric grew up watching his dad play football. These are really fond memories for him. But the old club fell apart before Cedric was old enough to play for them. And so he played for several other non-African clubs instead, secretly hoping that one day he'd have the chance to form a new African team. All those years of waiting are now paying off. By halftime, Africa FC are ahead 2-0 against TuS Ehrenfeld, their opponents.
We did a good job scoring these two goals. If we dribbled less, we could have scored two or three more. There's not much coming from our opponents.
But in the second half, Ehrenfeld step up. And suddenly, Africa FC are only one goal ahead. The score is 3-2. The mood on and off the pitch is getting tense. But then a pass finds Cedric. It's just him against the goalkeeper. Cedric nudges the ball past him and it rolls into the back of the net. Jacob is jumping up and down the sideline. Both sides score once more after that, but Africa FC hold on to the win. The final score is 5-3.
Malte Rover Kalman with that report.
Speaking out.
For decades, South African gold miners have been working under conditions that put their health and lives at risk. As a result, some 300,000 miners now suffer from lung fibrosis, also called silicosis. There is no cure for the disease that's caused by inhaling dust in the gold mines. Now, several thousand miners are taking the gold industry to court in a class action lawsuit, fighting for compensation worth billions. Jan-Philippe Schluter met some of the miners in the Eastern Cape, and this report is being presented by Gabriel Borud.
Whenever I cough, my chest feels very dry. It feels as if there were dust in my lungs. I want to get rid of it, but it doesn't come out.
There is so much pressure on my chest, it's difficult for me to breathe. Sometimes it feels as if I were suffocating.
Miltjana Mtventla and Chantelo Mgidi have been toiling in South African gold mines for more than 20 years. Dust exposure inside the mines has damaged their lungs. High levels of silica dust exposure can cause silicosis, a lung disease leading to scarring of the lungs. It is debilitating and incurable. Most patients also get secondary diseases like tuberculosis, and many die. Silicosis is a typical occupational disease for gold miners. Chantelot was diagnosed with it 10 years ago. After his diagnosis, his employer declared him unfit for work, sacked him, and sent him home. Since then, Chantelot, who has deep wrinkles on his forehead, has had little choice but to sit in his round hut in the Hilambana village in the Eastern Cape. He was paid a lawful compensation of 40,000 rand. That's 2,000 euros in total for an incurable lung disease, a mere pittance to compensate for a destroyed life.
I am angry and disappointed. I worked hard for the mining companies, but now I'm ill and I can't do anything. Sometimes at night I dream of dying.
Mixoleleni Mbodlane is another former miner. He lives in a small clay hut situated in the rolling hills of the Eastern Cape. The wiry 53-year-old sits in a worn-out armchair looking tired. His body is frequently shaken by coughing attacks. He remembers how bad the security standards were back in the 1980s when he started working in the gold mines. No,
they gave us respiratory masks, but these masks didn't provide much protection. It's very hot and humid in the mines, and we would sweat heavily. When we breathed from our masks, they always got very wet, and the dust stuck to them. They were completely useless.
It's estimated that at least one in four gold miners, more than 200,000 in South Africa, suffer from silicosis. Several thousand of them are filing a class action lawsuit now, demanding better compensation for the occupational diseases they get while working in the mines. Richard Spohr is one of their lawyers. Spohr has been advocating workers' rights for many years.
Fixing the problem on the mines is also an expensive thing. We're talking here about deep-level gold mining, up to 3 kilometers underground, very confined spaces where the rock is very hot. To provide adequate ventilation to protect workers' health costs a lot of money. So it was much cheaper to allow people to get sick and to die and then to replace them.
The mining companies claim they have always adhered to the law, but Spohr doubts that. And he even questions the current laws regulating compensation for gold miners. For several years, the companies had exhausted all legal means available to prevent the impending class action of the miners. And it looks like the mining industry is set to continue playing for time. But time is running out for Mitliana Mitwendla and tens of thousands of fellow miners.
I'm afraid that I won't live long. I could die any day. Just like my father and many other friends, I hope that I will still be alive when they reach an agreement.
A report by Jan-Philippe Schlüter.
And heading back to Cameroon, with little information coming out of the country in regards to these protests that we discussed earlier, many have been turning to Twitter to send out both videos and photos. And I have to tell you that some of the videos of these police beatings of unarmed students are very disturbing, and some of them showing the arrests of students at Buea University. And because of these disturbing videos, activists are calling on all Cameroonians to continue to send out information on the protests on social media. And Bamenda commented that all Cameroon social media activists are called to forward, tag, retweet all info, pics, videos, and to all international media and human rights organizations. And Papilou Dovich wrote that they have guns and sticks, we've got phones and the internet. The world will know what's going on.
So what about the Cameroonians themselves? Are they reacting to the videos?
Well, they're mostly reacting with shock and disgust, and these videos are quite brutal. And Patrick wrote that police brutality is unacceptable, and we need to work out a solution together as the people of Cameroon. And Janae Renee wrote, the only victory we want in Buea is for someone to be held accountable. And finally, Kawala said that we are organizing legal support for those violated or detained in Buea.
Thanks, Ole. Elsewhere in the news, South Sudan's President Salva Kiir has denied allegations by the United Nations that ethnic cleansing in the country's conflict is so bad that the stage is set for genocide. Well, that's all we had for today. Remember, you can find more stories about Africa on our website. That's dw.com/Africa. Visit us on our Facebook page. That's DW Africa. For me, Eunice Njiro.
And for me, Oli Tangen Jr.
It's bye for now.